From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we continue our talk with the man many rock fans call the greatest guitarist in the world, Eric Clapton. Today, Clapton tells us about his years with Cream and Blind Faith, and he talks about his long tenure as a solo artist. Also today, we meet South African pianist and composer Abdullah Ibrahim. He was driven from his country by apartheid and settled in America, the home of Duke Ellington, Thelonious Monk, and many of the other jazz musicians who inspired his playing. And poet Mark Halliday reads two poems about the passage of time. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. In Czechoslovakia, after days of turbulent negotiations, the new Prime Minister, Marian Čaflo, has agreed to a new government which could have communists in a minority position. Sylvia Poggioli has more from Prague.
After a first meeting with the opposition movement Civic Forum, Prime Minister Marian Čaflo appeared on TV this evening. He said a government formed half of members of all the political parties and half of people not affiliated with any party was acceptable. The opposition has called a general strike if there is no government by Sunday. Earlier today, President Gustav Husak issued an amnesty for political prisoners. The action came after Civic Forum stepped up its demands for Husak's resignation and his replacement by the opposition leader, playwright Václav Havel. In Prague, this is Sylvia Poggioli.
In an emergency party congress in East Berlin, the East German Communist Party is debating whether to refound and rename itself. The party has been plunged into a crisis by a corruption scandal among former party leaders. Deidre Berger has more from Berlin.
The party congress opened with a strong appeal by Prime Minister Hans Modrow to preserve a socialist East Germany. Keynote speaker Gregor Gysi pleaded against dissolving the crisis-ridden party. He told party delegates they must face up to the failure of Stalinism and work on a renewal of socialist principles. The party's corruption scandal reached the upper echelons of power today. The East German government filed criminal charges against former leader Erich Honecker and five other former top officials. Four of the six men were arrested. Prosecutors said the ailing 77-year-old Honecker is too ill to be questioned. The party congress is expected to last until early morning. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Berlin.
The United States confirmed today that Iraq launched a rocket powerful enough to put a small payload into space. It raises the possibility that Iraq has missile capability to hit Israel or targets farther away. Iraq announced Tuesday's launch yesterday, but officials elsewhere were skeptical that an Arab nation that recently concluded an 8-year war with Iran could achieve such a feat. The Pentagon said today the battleship New Jersey has entered the Persian Gulf, the first time since such a U.S. warship has sailed into the Gulf in modern times. Pentagon spokesman Keith Snyder said the vessel entered the Gulf last night on a routine operation to demonstrate a continuing U.S. commitment to the region. President Bush gave Defense Secretary Dick Cheney a $292.5 billion military spending limit for fiscal 1991. That's a $6.5 billion increase over last year, although after inflation, it represents about a 2% cut. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 10 points to close at 2731.23. Advances led declines 4-3 on volume of 145 million shares. This is NPR News. Philippine President Corazon Aquino today urged Filipinos to unite against those she says will destroy our democracy. Addressing a crowd of more than 100,000 people in Manila, Aquino said she would not relinquish her office to Vice President Salvador Laurel, who has become a political rival. Laurel has suggested that both he resign and Corazon Aquino. Meanwhile, 350 miles away, the last army mutineers still hold a large airbase 1 week after an attempted coup led by disgruntled military officers. President Bush was on the campaign trail in Denver today, helping raise money for a Colorado Senate candidate and to push his war on drugs at a local high school. Mark Roberts has the story.
The president used his visit to Denver to promote the Senate campaign for Colorado Republican Congressman Hank Brown, who hopes to replace retiring Republican Senator Bill Armstrong. The president also brought his anti-drug message to an enthusiastic crowd of high school students, urging them to stay away from drugs and to help stop the deaths associated with drugs.
Some people just think of themselves as peer group, casual users. There's nothing casual about buying drugs from people who consider killing to be a cost of doing business.
The president ended his remarks saying that in some way drugs do pay. President Bush then presented checks totaling more than $2 million to local law enforcement agencies, the money coming from the seizure of cash and assets following a 1981 Colorado drug bust. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
Defense electronics contractor Laurel Corporation pleaded guilty today to federal charges of fraud and obtaining inside information on defense contracts and agreed to pay the government nearly $6 million. The case is part of the government's ongoing probe of fraud and abuse in the defense industry. Prosecutors have now obtained more than 20 convictions or guilty pleas by firms and individuals on a wide range of contracts. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross with the second half of our interview with Eric Clapton. Clapton is one of rock's virtuoso guitarists, one of the first guitar heroes, and guitar godfather to many of the heavy metal bands of the 70s and 80s. He has a new album called Journeyman. Last time on Fresh Air, Clapton talked about his early career in the British blues scene as a member of the Yardbirds and John Mayall's Blues Breakers. In the mid-60s, he was ready to soften his purist approach to the blues. He formed Cream with bassist and singer Jack Bruce and drummer Ginger Baker. Cream did play some blues standards, but they also played a lot of original material and became known for their extended improvised solos. Here's one of those jams with Eric Clapton on guitar from a 1968 Cream recording of the Robert Johnson blues classic Crossroads. What was it like for you to learn to take sustained solos in concerts? Were you used to doing that before Cream?
Yes, I think we did it with... I think John would encourage me to play as long as I liked, but I had a much more controlled idea about what it should be then. With Cream, it came out of a very basic kind of necessity situation. The first gig we ever played at a big jazz festival in England, we ran out of material after about an hour, and the crowd wanted more, and they weren't going to give up, and so we literally had to go and jam, and we found that that became the most popular part of our act, was when we didn't have anything set to play, and we would just play off the top of our heads, and it worked. A lot of the time it really worked.
I'm wondering if there were times at concerts when everyone in the band was really high and nearly everybody in the audience was really high, and it would lead to this almost self-indulgent, you know, length in solos. Did you ever feel that way?
Yeah, I can remember playing at the Fillmore many times, at Fillmore West, when, you know, it was just like being in someone's front room with everyone smashed out of their brains listening to the stereo, and we were the stereo, really.
So was that a good feeling or an alienating feeling?
Well, I'm not going to pretend it was anything but great.
Okay,
I thought it was fantastic.
My guest is Eric Clapton. Why don't we listen to the opening of one of Cream's best-known records?
I'll soon be with you, my love. Give you my dog's surprise.
On something like Sunshine of Your Love, which has this now really famous opening lick, do you consider that part of the composition, or is that something that was added afterwards, and who came up with that?
Well, that's Jack. We went to see Jimi Hendrix. Jimmy was a dear friend of ours, and this was like 1967. There was a theatre in London called the Savile Theatre where everyone at the time was playing, and we went to see Jimmy play there, and Jack and I were in a box looking down, and I think it was the first time Jack had really listened to Jimmy properly, you know, and he was overwhelmed, and that night he went home and wrote that riff, and the song was actually written on the riff. It wasn't added, you know, that wasn't the... that was the other way around from the way that you think. You know, we didn't add the riff to the song. We added the song to the riff.
And Crossroads, which is one of the Cream records that I think you must have initiated. It's a Robert Johnson song that I'm sure it was you who decided to record. You do the vocal on it. It was one of the few Cream records that you were the solo singer
on.
Tell me why you wanted to record that.
I'd had the Robert Johnson album for many years by then, and I was pretty well familiar with all of the songs on there, and I thought that was the best one. I mean, I always wanted to do Robert Johnson's songs in different... I mean, the first one I did was with John Mayall. I did Rambling on My Mind.
Which you sang also, yeah.
Yeah, but then with Cream, each time we made a record, I would find some way of arranging a Robert Johnson song to put on there. But Crossroads, to me, was the one that summed up... I didn't know it then, but I guess it must have summed me up in many ways, but it summed up Robert Johnson's story, you know.
How do you think it summed up your story?
Because I've been at that crossroads many times in my life in many different ways, musically, personally, business-wise, just geographically. I'm often at that place, and I kind of follow my own nose. I don't really know where I'm going a lot of the time.
What did the whole Clapton is God period have on you? What effect did it have on you when people were writing that kind of graffiti on walls?
Well, I don't think I actually ever saw it. You know, isn't that the funny thing? I don't think.
Is this all apocryphal? I mean, I can swear I've seen it.
I've only ever heard it said, and I've seen a picture of a wall in London. And it's a funny picture. There's this brick wall in London with Clapton is God written on it in white, chalk or paint, I don't know what. And at the bottom of the picture, there's a dog peeing against the wall. You know? And that kind of sums up my attitude towards it. But I don't think I've ever actually seen it in the flesh. So it's all something that I've had to accept from other people. As far as that goes, it's a bit like someone kind of paying you the highest compliment they can think of. And in that respect, I've tried to learn to accept it graciously.
Mm-hmm.
In the early days, I would just I was thoroughly disgusted with the whole thing. But as time has gone by, I've learned to say thank you.
A couple of years ago, you did an interview with Robert Palmer for, I guess it was in the New York Times, maybe it was in Rolling Stone, New York Times. Okay. And you had told him that John Landau had written a review of a Cream concert.
That's right.
And he gave it a really bad review. And you said that the Ring of Truth knocked you backwards, and that's when you decided that you wanted to leave Cream. Why did that review have such a profound effect on you?
Well, it was tied in with a long, in-depth interview which I had done in Sausalito. If my memory serves me right, I had been flying high, and we'd been playing the film or we're stoned and everything. And really, we were God's gift to music, you know, and I was blathering on about all this. And on the next page was this fantastic review, and I was summed up as being the master of the cliché. And juxtaposed with this... with this interview, the effect was astonishing. And I remember reading the article in a restaurant. I was with some friends in Boston, and I read the whole thing in silence, and the other guys were just sitting around having a conversation. I stood up to go to the loo and passed out. I mean, it had that severe. And I remember waking up, not coming around in the restaurant. I was taken, carried out of the restaurant and put in someone's house, and waking up thinking, what the hell is going on? And immediately thinking, I've got to get out of this. You know, that whole thing was right. And I've been playing this awful game, a musical game, for too long, and I've got to leave that band and this and that and plan a new life. It had a devastating effect on me.
Was it because you were embarrassed, insulted, or because you felt that you needed to be moving in a new musical direction?
The last part is what... I mean, I was ashamed because I think inside I had known for quite a while that we were really... we were selling the audiences short, you know. We were going on stage stoned, and we were playing just kind of meaningless... a lot of the time, anyway, meaningless, endless solos, and people were swallowing it. And I was starting to feel rather ashamed of the whole thing because we were resting on our laurels, to say the least. You know, we weren't sitting down thinking about new ways to to write songs or developing the music of the band. We had got stuck in a rut by that point.
Mm-hmm. So you did leave Cream because of that?
Yes, I did. I mean, I said to the guys, I've got to leave. You know, I've got to do something else or just stop. You know, I don't want to do this anymore. And I think we'd approached this situation for other reasons before. You know, we were constantly having rows about one thing or another. And then we talked to the manager about it. He decided we should do one farewell tour, you know, and make a farewell album, which is what we did. And at that point, actually, funnily enough, as it does happen in many other walks of life, we became suddenly very much closer. And I think during the farewell concert we did at the Albert Hall, there was a great deal of regret and nostalgia on my part, and I wasn't sure if I was doing the right thing.
Looking back, what do you think?
Yes, I think now, after all this time, I think I had a lot of other things to do that I couldn't have done if I'd stayed with that band.
My guest is Eric Clapton. He has a new album called Journeyman. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Eric Clapton, and he has a new album out called Journeyman. You, not too long after that, I guess, formed Blind Faith. I think for the first Blind Faith concert, there was like an audience of 36,000. What was it like for you to go from starting off playing in small clubs and ending up playing these huge concerts, you know, stadium concerts? It's quite a transition, and it was right at the very beginning of that period where concerts got that big. I mean, so it's not something you could have been expecting.
I think we were sort of lulled into a full sense of security there. I think we assumed that this particular concert we did was going to be a one-off. You know, then we would go back to clubs, or at least it would be interspersed. You know, we were probably going to do in our minds anyway, you know, big halls now and then mainly clubs. But of course, halfway through the American tour, the whole thing started to get very jaded because we were only playing stadiums and we weren't ready. We had barely enough material to do, you know, an hour and a half. And outside of that, we were empty, you know, and that wasn't the way it wanted to be. We wanted to be, at least Steve Winwood and myself, wanted to be like a very integral band that could play for hours, you know, and learn lots of songs and just have a whole wealth of material, something that you would take years to develop. And, of course, we never were given that chance.
Mm-hmm. You eventually took a hiatus from music, and you spent a couple of years doing a lot of drugs.
Yeah, basically doing a lot of drugs. Yeah, I can't remember where it started. I've always been I've always had a leaning towards addictions, you know, one way or another, an obsessive personality to say the least. And even when I was 16, it was like peer pressure. To everyone was taking amphetamine or different kind, or drinking wine. You know, it was part of life, it seemed to be, to get stoned. And I realized now that I was going to end up, you know, on the heap. And I pretty well got close to that. And during the early 70s, I got as close to killing myself with drugs as I could ever get. And it started out the way it always starts out, you know, smoking a joint or taking a few pills. And for some people, it escalates very quick. For me, it took a long time, but I got there, and I diced with death for a while, and I regret it. That's for sure.
Did you have like a bottoming out moment where you figured this is it? I've got to change.
Yeah, I think it's funny because it's difficult to be. I mean, when you're that stoned, it's difficult to be. To stand outside of yourself and see how far you've gone, you know, because you're so wrapped up in it. Other people can tell you, but it's very difficult for you to see yourself. And it happened to me at some point. I'd had friends come and stay with me, and they were virtually like my jailers, you know. They were making sure that I didn't harm myself. I was taking lots of heroin. I was taking Mandrax, which is a powerful, like a Quaalude equivalent. I was drinking lots of hard liquor. And at some point, I remember seeing myself, and this is true, sitting in my car at dawn, totally naked, trying to start it. And what I was doing, I was trying to escape from my own house where these people were trying to look after me. And it, thank God, one of the guys had taken out the rotor arm of the engine, and I was just sitting there trying to start the car, totally naked. I don't know where I was going to go, but I had a flash then that things had gone a little too far. So I, that was when I decided to kind of start doing something about it.
And what did you do?
I went to an acupuncturist who had set up a practice in London using a fairly revolutionary form of treatment whereby she passed a small electric current from one ear to the other and induced a sort of a mild natural narcosis, which took away the withdrawal symptoms which you get when you're trying to stop taking heroin.
Mm-hmm.
The point was, of course, that I hadn't actually used it, I'd never taken heroin intravenously, so it wasn't that hard a habit for me to kick. It was quite hard, but I did it with the help of this acupuncturist.
Did you ever think that an addiction to drugs, an obsession with drugs, is kind of related to, in a way, the same kind of obsession that allows you to spend as many hours as you must have developing your guitar playing? Do you know what I mean? Because you've been obsessive about guitar playing and about your music.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. I like to think of my guitar, my love for guitar playing, as being dedicated. But it's not far removed from being obsessive. I mean, there's a fine line between those two words. And what happened when I became obsessed with drug taking was that obviously my guitar playing took second place. And, you know, one is a natural kind of dedication and the other one is a very unnatural dedication.
For a while after you gave up heroin, I know you had some alcohol problems for a while. I was wondering if you ever had any reservations about doing a Michelob beer commercial, having been an alcoholic.
Well, I think I would think twice about it now. I'm not saying that I wouldn't do it because I like advertising, actually. I mean, I'm a fan.
You mean like watching it on TV, you like the jingles, or what?
Yeah, I'm not so crazy about this country's, but I love English advertising, and European advertising in general is a very high caliber, and a lot of American advertising too. And so, if it's done well, I like to get involved in somewhere. And I tell you, the funny thing is that I've just kind of just remembered about that Michelob thing was that at the time I needed some exposure. I really did. It was actually possible for me to wander around and people not even know they knew that Eric Clapton was a guitar player, that they didn't know what he looked like. That's the truth. And they didn't, they'd never seen him on TV. I'd only done maybe one or two TV shows in my life, been involved in a cameo performance in The Last Waltz or something like that. So it occurred to me to be a good vehicle if I was going to be more accessible and to sell more records or whatever, sell more tickets at concerts, to do something like that. And that was the perfect vehicle for it.
Was it effective for that?
For that, yes, it was. It was. People began to recognize me on the street, which is something I'm in two minds about. I like it and I don't like it, but it was something. I mean, I have to tip my hat to Phil here. He actually said, look, man, you've got to do it because people don't know what you look like.
To Phil Collins?
People want to know. They want to know what you're like and show them,
So did the commercial help to sell records too?
I think so, yeah, uh-huh. I think so. I think it was instrumental in breaking me with a wider public all over.
Mm-hmm. Eric Clapton is my guest, and he has a new record, and the new record is called Journeyman. I want to ask you something about your past, about your very beginnings, actually. I know you've talked about this, that your mother had you, she wasn't married, and she left, I think, shortly after you were born, and you were brought up by your grandparents, who told you that they were actually your parents, and when your mother returned, you were told at first that she was your sister. And I'm wondering what effects you think that had on your public identity. Do you know what I mean? On your public sense of self.
It's very complicated, isn't it? I mean, whatever the result was, has to be a complicated result, isn't it, when you think about it? I've got so many different sides of my nature as a result of that upbringing. I mean, I think there's a side of me that, you know, dreads rejection, dreads abandonment. There's another side that sort of loves solitude, and I don't know. It's had all kinds of effects on me, most of which I've kind of started to deal with over the last few years and come to terms with. And if I can, I change parts of my personality that cause me difficulty, or I at least accept them. But for sure, it was an unusual upbringing, you know.
Is your mother still alive?
Yes, she is, and we're great pals. We're more like brother and sister than anything else, because she's, you know, she's not that much older than me, because she was, when I was born, she was 15. And so really, the age difference isn't that much. And because we didn't spend time as mother and son when I was young, we're family members, but it's almost difficult to say what kind of family members we are.
Do you call her Mom?
Yeah, I do. I call her Ma, but then sometimes I call her Pat too, which is her name. And it's a funny situation. It's a very loving situation, and it's finally come full circle to where everyone is kind of relaxed about it now.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, I know you converted to Christianity several years ago. Are you still a Christian?
Oh, I've always been a Christian. I mean, I was raised in England, in what we call Church of England, C of E, and that's really just basic. I think it's like Protestant, really. And I went to Sunday school, and I went to church quite a lot. And I just stopped going when I started, you know, hitting the road as a kid, you know, as a teenager. Really, I had a kind of, I think you could call it a pseudo-religious experience in the early 70s. But it was all tied up with drugs and everything, so I don't take it so seriously now. But I pray, you know, and I believe in a God of my understanding that kind of works when I work for it, you know. And I don't shove it down anyone's throat, and I don't talk about it very much. But I do have a kind of belief system that works more or less on a kind of karma basis, you know, that if I do well, things will go well, that sort of thing.
Tell me a little bit about putting together your new record. Different tracks have different guest artists on it. Some of the songs are old songs by Ray Charles or Muddy Waters. Some of them are new songs co-written by you or written by friends.
Well, bearing in mind that the Crossroads box set did well, and that seemed to be such a kind of a random look at my musical career, it spurred me to just go into the studio and do what I felt like doing, you know, and literally going one day at a time, making it up as we went along. So I almost left my mind a blank until I went into the studio. And the first thing that I wanted to do was do Hard Times, the Ray Charles song, and then just see what happened. And we had a lot of songs being sent to us. I had written some songs, which weren't very good, to be honest, and there were some covers that I wanted to do, but it all just seemed to be like a blank page to me, and we filled it in day by day.
Well, Eric Clapton, we're out of time. I regret it. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. Great talking to you.
Eric Clapton has a new record called Journeyman. Beginning on January 18th, Clapton will perform for 18 nights at the Royal Albert Hall in London. He expects this run to make it into the Guinness Book of World Records. During the first few nights, he'll play with a 4-piece band, then he'll be with a 13-piece band with horns. He'll do 3 nights of blues with Robert Cray and Buddy Guy, and then he'll perform with the National Philharmonic Orchestra. He'll start a U.S. tour in the spring. I'm Terry Gross, this is Fresh Air, and this is from Eric Clapton's new album, Journeyman.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's music by exiled South African composer and pianist Abdullah Ibrahim. His music draws from the townships, American jazz, and church spirituals. It's music of great beauty that's shaped in part by the evil of apartheid. Coming up, Abdullah Ibrahim discusses his life in South Africa and the U.S. And as another year draws to a close, poet Mark Halliday reads a couple of poems about the passage of time. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Michael Richards. East Germany's Communist Party today opened an emergency congress. Some communist leaders are warning that the existence of a socialist East Germany is at stake. The crisis meeting opened just hours after six of the party's longtime leaders, including former party leader Erich Honecker, were brought up on criminal charges of corruption. In Czechoslovakia, the communists today offered to become a minority party in a new governing coalition. It's the first time in 41 years of communist rule that the party has offered to relinquish control. While in Bulgaria, the Communist Party Central Committee purged several hardliners, including the one-time party chief, Tudor Zhivkov. Thousands turned out in Manila today for a rally in support of President Corazon Aquino. Addressing her supporters, Aquino accused her vice president of being involved in continuing efforts to overthrow her government. The BBC's Humphrey Hawksley reports.
After a week in which she came close to being overthrown and the presidential palace was bombed, this was the show of grassroots support that Mrs. Aquino had been hoping for. A crowd stretching back as far as the eye could see, chanting Corrie, Corrie, Corrie when she addressed them in a tough speech, urging them to support the democratic system. She drew cheers when she named three of her most powerful political opponents, including the vice president, Salvador Laurel, who's refused to condemn the coup attempt. And before he said mass to the crowd, the Archbishop of Manila, Cardinal Jaime Sin, spoke of many politicians who would like to be president without waiting for elections. But despite her euphoric reception, the threat of more military rebellions in the Philippines has not ended. And even as she spoke, 400 rebel troops were still holding a major airbase near the central city of Cebu.
Humphrey Hawksley in Manila. Israel today said it was accepting an American invitation for talks on the Palestinian question. Egypt will also be there. It's designed to pave the way for eventual direct talks between Israel and Palestinian representatives. But at this stage, no Palestinians will be participating. Today is the eve of the Palestinian uprising, and Israel has imposed severe restrictions in the West Bank and on the Gaza Strip. NPR's John Hockenberry reports.
Nearly a million people have been placed under curfew in the Israeli-occupied territories today, and massive troop and police reinforcements have been deployed to repress any commemorations of the second anniversary of the Palestinian uprising. The situation has changed dramatically from a year ago when the Palestinian uprising was monopolizing world attention and Israeli official attention. Now, one elderly Palestinian remarked today in a West Bank village, "The world has forgotten our struggle, but we cannot." Israel has managed to contain the worst of the violence in the past year, yet the casualties from the Intifada have continued to mount, undiminished by new tactics and new weapons. The curfews and restrictions are expected to remain throughout the weekend. This is John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
Stock prices finished higher today on Wall Street. The Dow rose more than 10 points to close at 2731.23. Advances led declines 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Abdullah Ibrahim is the South African composer who has had the greatest impact on jazz in the U.S. Ibrahim grew up in the port city of Cape Town. His grandmother founded the South African branch of the AME Church. His mother was a church pianist. In the early 60s, Ibrahim led a South African jazz band that featured uMasekela on trumpet. Apartheid drove Ibrahim out of his country in the 60s. Duke Ellington helped Ibrahim establish himself in the States by producing his first American record. Ibrahim lives in Manhattan now with his wife, the singer Satima B. Benjamin, and their children. He has recorded with his septet, Akaya. He's led sessions with smaller groups and has recorded several solo piano albums. His new record, Minda, features his music from the film Chocolat. From it, this is African Market, featuring Ibrahim on piano. Thank you. How did you first hear jazz?
Well, we could hardly afford to buy records. You know, it was so expensive. But in the community, of course, there were always enterprising young men, like they say, with no visible means of support, who gave us all the assistance, and they normally had access to records. So most of the music or records were heard from these people, and of course there was Voice of America.
It was when you were growing up, or when you were a young man, in Cape Town, that you got the nickname of Dollar Brand. You were born with the name Adolf Brand. Can you tell me the story of how you got the nickname?
One of our most potent sources of information of what was going on in the music world in the United States was from African-American seamen. And sometimes on board were, you know, there were musicians and sometimes just seamen who loved the music, and they had the latest record. So we would go down to the harbor, Cape Town Harbor, and meet these seamen and bring them home. So that's how I got the name, the nickname at least, of Dollar, from hanging out with these African-American seamen.
Why the name Dollar, though?
Because of the American money. It's still a status symbol anywhere else in the world to possess some.
So did you like your name?
Not really, but there was nothing that I could do about it. You know, my family and friends, although I've taken Shahada and became Muslim and changed my name to Abdullah Ibrahim, they still refer to me as Dollar. But I think it sounds endearing. So we forgive.
You know, it's funny, when I'm looking for one of your records in a record store, you sometimes don't know whether it's going to be under Brand or Ibrahim.
Yes, well, we have this ongoing, problem with marketing people. And they, as much as we insist that we should only use Abdullah Ibrahim, they, in some cases, insist in using both names. And their explanation to it is that people do not know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that is not really, the problem. You know, the name change was actually not a name change for the sake of name change, but when I accepted Islam, it was a change for a better life.
Mm-hmm. What was it that finally made you decide to leave South Africa? Was there a last straw or a breaking point?
There are vivid images and memories of confrontation with apartheid and being subjected to its brutality. So one has decision to make. Either you stay there and toe the line, or you leave and try to carry on or play the music, or you stop. We just stop and give in, like has happened to so many of our talented people.
What were some of the restrictions that were placed on you?
In terms of the system of apartheid?
Right, and in terms of where you could play or what you could play or how far you could travel.
Well, the system of apartheid sets horrendous boundaries on one's freedom, not just as a musician, but as a human being. We absolutely have no rights. When I was in high school, I was the first in my family to be able to go to high school, and then my great grandfather was medicine man. He was a herbalist. You see, he knew all the herbs from Southern Africa and taught us. He also spoke all the Southern African languages very fluently. In fact, all my family are involved in traditional healing, and of course, with the advent of the of the modern contemporary urban living, they were drawn into the church. So at an early age, I was exposed to that. And of course, the family wanted me to carry on that tradition and become a doctor. When I finished high school, I was refused entry into the, like many others, entry into the medical school. We were considered not human, capable of pursuing this. So that was at a dead end. In terms of the music, it was probably for me the only means of escape, because at least we could play in our own environment. So I grew up in playing dance bands behind vocal groups, playing variety concerts. But the main halls or main arena of activity on a social, economic, and political from those aspects were completely denied to us.
Abdullah Ibrahim is my guest. He is an exiled South African composer and pianist now living in New York. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is composer and pianist Abdullah Ibrahim. He's an exiled South African now living in New York. After you left South Africa, you returned again in the mid-70s and recorded some sessions there that are being reissued now. And one of the pieces that has recently been reissued is your piece Cape Town Fringe. And I know that this was very popular in South Africa at the time of the Soweto Uprising. Can you tell me about writing and recording this piece?
Yes. It was after deep contemplation, being out all those years, that we decided to go back. But it was at the time when I took Shahada, when I became Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And the feeling was that I could still go back, hopefully. Well, they allowed me in. And that was on the way to making Hajj, going to Makkah for pilgrimage, and I needed to do it from home. And it was at that time that I got together this group of young musicians, and we recorded a lot of music. The song Cape Town Fringe was recorded in Cape Town. The original title is called Manenberg. Manenberg is a township on the outskirts of Cape Town, the counterpart of Soweto, perhaps. It was when the album was released in this country, the marketing people decided to call it Cape Town Fringe, which I think was agreeable, because the township, or just the word Manenberg, was completely, I think, foreign to people here.
Mm-hmm.
Like always, as always, in any struggle, and especially in Southern Africa, the music has played a very important role. We recorded this, we were in a studio in Cape Town, and this piece of music came in the studio. We were busy recording some other pieces. And we recorded it just one take and left it, but we all felt so elated because we felt that we had captured the mood of the people at the time.
on the original recording of Mannenberg, recorded in the mid-70s, you're playing electric piano, which I don't think you play anymore.
No.
How does it sound to you listening back to it, the electric piano?
Sounds good.
Uh-huh.
But the reason for doing that was because we needed to take the music out to the people. I mean, live. And sometimes it was problematic to have an acoustic piano, let alone a grand piano. So we utilized the electric piano. That was really the only reason for it.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Have you been to South Africa since the Soweto Uprising?
No, this was 1976 that we came out with my wife, our son, and daughter. And we haven't returned there because the regime refused to renew my passport. And of course, they say that they do not. It's not necessary for them really to answer and give us a reason why. But since we've become United States citizens.
Mm-hmm. Would you go back if the regime was toppled and apartheid ended?
Immediately.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of us feel that way.
Mm-hmm. Are your records available in South Africa now?
Yes, some of them have been banned. These were the more vocal, vocal ones, but the
vocal ones because there's words that you
exactly,
can take literally, right?
Exactly.
When you left South Africa, you met Duke Ellington, and he was very helpful for you. In fact, I think he was responsible for your first recording outside of South Africa.
That's right.
I think your music still sounds very influenced by Ellington. Do you feel that way?
How can we escape Ellington?
Who would want to?
Exactly. Even if people want to deny it, there's no way. We do not just mean jazz musicians, but contemporary 20th century music, any way and anywhere that it is played, how can you escape Ellington?
Holding a rehearsal with your musicians and you're teaching them or giving them a new piece of yours, how do they learn it? Do you give them music? Do you write it down for them? Do you sing it to them, play it for them? What do you do?
Well, the musicians have a saying when we say we're going to have rehearsals, and they say, where's the paper? Because I ask them to notate the basic skeleton of the piece first. So what I would do is, when there's a new piece, the piano is like a command post. And I just come into the studio and start playing, even while they're busy setting up and talking about fried chicken they had or where they visited the night before. And whoever hears it first will pick it up. And so the song is built around that person, the first one who picks it up and finds an interest.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So what do you mean it's built around them? Like the
okay.
they'll get the first solo or?
No, not the first solo, but perhaps the lead.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What a really nice interaction. I guess also it makes, it's kind of something of an incentive to make sure people pick up on it really quickly, because then they'll be more prominent.
Yeah, because the idea is really not to write notes and give it to people to play.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
It's the other way around, and that's why the so-called jazz music is so precious. It is so precious. It's perhaps the last bastion of human creativity.
You know, when you were playing jazz in South Africa, the music was very popular, and in America, jazz is much more marginalized right now. It's very little of it, sells a lot or is on the charts or has a really large following. Do you miss that sense of the music having this real kind of popular acceptance and of it having even a political implication that's picked up on by a lot of listeners?
No, it really doesn't bother us, because we understand what the problem is, and we are working towards solving it. See, basically the problem is that most of the playing is not community-based. Most of the playing is done in clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And so invariably the music that is written for the gig, or written for the recording, session. Whereas with us, the music is written specifically for a function within the community. That is what the difference is. And the music used to function. The music used to function here, in the community. But there is a strong and vital unfolding and initiation by people in this country to take the music back into that arena. And it is possible.
Abdullah Ibrahim, I thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Abdullah Ibrahim's new album, Mindif, is on Inja Records. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We're going to get the latest news from the Philippines and what is happening with President Corazon Aquino, and then we have an interview on the program this evening with Vice President Salvador Laurel, the man who said that he would be happy to assume the presidency if Cory Aquino were overthrown. We're still looking at the defense budget. Will there be a peace dividend, and if so, what form would it take? And then we have a day in the life of a member of the Soviet legislature and a television star, the Energizer Bunny, Terry, the cool bunny in the Ray-Bans with the drum.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Poet Mark Halliday is with us again to read two poems about moments in time. The title of the first is an address where Mark once lived.
64 Elm Grove. I was there. That was me. There I was in the gray light. That day slipped like a raft on the Susquehanna, like a raft on the Shenandoah, sliding a little sideways like an old raft of worn boards on the Housatonic. At the kitchen sink I stood seeing yellow-brown grass matted in the backyard of 64 Elm Grove, and time passed. Jessica traveled emphatically down the hall in her boots, defying various fears. Happiness turned on its old famous wheel till odd silence and sad little touches took its place. There was that tangle of wet colors in the autumn yard, and then I was gone. Jessica was long gone, and my U-Haul truck trembled with fear of change. I am not at all a Hindu. I've never been a Hindu. I want to keep things. What I can't lose is the feeling that things are taken away because I haven't understood the right way to hold them close. If you love me, Jessica said, you have to let me grow. And I guess I did. And there was gray light in the kitchen. On the round table there were white coffee mugs till the whole house floated fast down river, till I stand now staring as if through a kitchen window at yellow-brown grass, as if staring could reassemble what was tangled and then became a runaway raft so easily, as if the white mugs and the piano and the wine-stained rug and how Jessica walked had not been worth keeping. I'm often troubled by the feeling of life being too big in the present, too many lives being led around me. Here's a poem in which I try to console myself about that by reminding myself that the same thing must have been true for someone living 60 years ago. Already in 1927. Summer night in quiet, level suburban streets. Lights still on in 2 out of 3 houses. 5 small green lights edge the driveway of a brick house 2 doors down. Cold lights in the warm, dark air. Hundreds of lives within 3 blocks. Persons who look away. And this is only one modest suburb in North Carolina or Connecticut. Too many persons who are looking away from you. But what about 1927? Then, too, lamps burned in thousands of windows within a few miles and were seen through the thick of summer night, meaning lives, averted, oblivious, unreachable. A boy and a girl said goodnight at the door, and from her window she watched him walk away into the ripe darkness of June 1927. She felt his steps leading to a city job and other girls, girls with expensive hats. She felt so small, lost, and so small. She sat in her bed for 20 minutes. Then she tied a paisley kerchief in her hair and washed her face and read a novel by Hardy and grew up and married a partly good man. She survived the infinity of 1927. Since already in 1927 the problem was present with all ingredients, the steps fading, lamplight cold in the warm air on this block and the next block. So, it's an old condition. The liquid darkness and voices from the far side of the playground, newspaper on the Davenport filled with unromantic activity, what Coolidge said about aid to farmers. Already in 1927, you had to pass through squares of darkness and small circles of yellow light alone. My father, for instance, was 13. He shut the back door and climbed the creaky stairs, making plans.
Mark Halliday's collection of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the music reviews and arts commentaries. Our production assistants are Roberta Shurrock and Joan Tui. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from saxophonist Tim Byrne. His last album turned up on many critics' 10 best lists right at the same time the record company dropped him. And television critic David Bianculli previews the season premiere of Beauty and the Beast. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.